The purpose of this final panel discussion, as usual, is sort of to draw things together and to benefit from the disciplined reflections of the presenters and some interaction among them, and then also to possibly draw them out from the floor so we have the full benefit of, well, tying up all the loose ends. I have two written questions, which in due course I shall present, but I should like to begin in this way. I would like to begin by asking each member of the panel, in order of their appearance, I think that will be the best way to do it, to ask each member, in a brief, ah, there's Dr. Green, jolly good, would you come, we saved you a chair. That's a very worthy cause. Oh dear.
I will be my usual.
Yes, well, that's a picture of certain things too, isn't it? A coffee that is not coffee. Now,
thank you.
I should like to ask every member of the panel, in order of their appearance, this rather to make a pointed statement, not to put too great a burden on them, as a, you know, some great prophetic message, but this, they have, after all, reflected on a particular topic. They've had taken the time and the discipline, and they, after all, are involved and immersed in certain disciplines. If they would now point their thoughts and think in light of what they have reflected on in their papers, and in light of the discussion also that they've heard here and elsewhere, what do they believe is important to stress today in our situation in North American Lutheranism? So what basic thing do they believe ought now to be paid attention to? And while they are thinking of that, they were not given much advance notice of this. And it's not essential to have anything very polished, but the thing is to say something, and then other members of the panel may respond to that. And then I have the written presentations, and then after that, questions from the floor as long as it's possible, but please, brethren, in view of the very great shortage of time now, keep the questions to a short and disciplined form. That's why I encourage them to be presented in writing. And the last thing that I want to mention is this. Well, there's one concern expressed by a brother here during the coffee hour, which I think is very valid, and that is this. Some one or other may feel that because they have participated in certain programs in all good faith which have been criticized by one of the or the other of the brethren here, therefore their confessional integrity or something like that is being challenged, and it should be said this is not the case. So I'm glad that this brother was sensitive to that, and I think it should be clear. It's very important that we should be able to get together here, and if necessary also to a certain extent tread on one another's toes. This sort of interchange is extremely important, because what's the alternative? The alternative is that we shall be so caught up in the passions and superstitions of our age, the zeitgeist, that then, as next Sunday's Old Testament lesson tells us, there will come a terrible famine of the word in Amos 8. Sasso once said that a great Australian Congregationalist told him, we have lost the word of God and we cannot find it again. There is such a thing as a famine of the word. We must make sure that in our existence as Christians and members and servants of the church, that we do not tempt God to send us a famine of that word. So, in order of appearance, Dr. Clam was the first one. Would you please, at this time, I think that microphone is on, make your statement.
Appearing first, one is most vulnerable, I suppose. And as you spoke, it occurred to me to refer to the picture, I think it was by Albrecht Dürer, of melancholia, which appeared before the Reformation.
Could you get a bit closer to that, or the other way about?
Sorry. The picture of Albrecht Dürer, which appeared before the Reformation, picturing the mind of Europe. It was entitled Melancholia. The lassitude of the woman, everything fell out of her hands. Book learning was, I suppose, in the reverse and so forth. He saw a very gloomy picture. The world of his time, when he pictured it, seemed to be at an end. Nothing could be done. Perhaps this was similar to that which Moses experienced according to when he left Egypt with the Israelites and the multitudes that attached themselves to them. On the one hand was the Red Sea, and the other side was Pharaoh's army. And the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people to go forward." Now, between the two, I think we can fit the discussions we've had the last couple of days. There is a tendency in our congregations to leave everything the way it was. You can't change a thing. Things are coming apart. And who knows, we'll be going under. It's not true. It's definitely not true, because the Lord Jesus Christ remains the Lord of history, the Lord of the church, the Lord of the future. And he said, go into all the world. Just as the Israelites heard the word through Moses, when God said, tell the people to go forward, not stand still, not have hot discussions or debates or recriminations, but go forward. The direction had been given. The route had been given. And the means were provided. I'm not talking about Cecil DeMille's Hollywood style of parting of the Red Sea. I'm talking about the guidance of Israel during those 40 years of wandering past all sorts of obstacles until they reached the land of promise. Well, many preachers have compared the course of the church to these wanderings, and all kinds of things happened during that time. There is one thing I believe we must consider very, very seriously. The moment the gospel is preached, somehow people believe additives are needed. The gospel can't stand by itself. We must introduce reasons why men, women, everyone, is able to make a specific contribution which is unique and not at all called for according to the revelation of the word. And this contribution of the human ego is the most dangerous thing we can imagine. According to Luther's explanation of the first article, God has made me and all creatures, has given me body, soul, eyes, ears, and all my members, and still preserves them. All I am is God's doing or permission. Not to omit the negative contributions of my own. Again, our Lord Jesus redeemed us that he may call us his own, and we may call him our own in his kingdom for blessedness and righteousness. The third article tells us we cannot know Jesus Christ or come to him. We have no means of hearing the gospel or the law, for that matter, which leads to contrition, unless faith is given. We're entirely dependent upon what God has said and done. And this was so in the very beginning, according to Genesis 2, when the law was given. Of every tree you may eat, but of the tree of good and knowledge thou shalt not eat. The next chapter we see that the faith in the law was lost. It was no longer believed. The command was not believed. And of course, once you lose faith in the law, you will do anything but the law. So faith must be attached or directed to both law and gospel. And this is a very serious matter in the church because our people think the law works automatically. Just speak it and will work. Pronounce the punishments and people will believe. Well, Adam and Eve didn't. And it's been so ever since. What should we do in view of people's remedies, such as church organization or church growth or church work? Since the beginning, organization, I believe, Mr. Chairman, was necessary. Moses organized the people, and he was given help by his father-in-law to have effective organization. The whole liturgical life of the Israelites depend upon organization. You cannot do it, cannot do without it. You can't study without organization. You can't work without organization. It is essential to our own work and progress. But don't think for one moment that organization works ex opere operato. That's nonsense. It does not. The finest organization will fall flat on its face, figuratively speaking, if it isn't imbued with the spirit behind it. And the Lord said, tell the people to go tell the people to go forward. His command had both the power and the effect of his intention. Mr. Chairman, I'd better stop here.
Thank you very much for the opening statement, Dr. Clank. Now, Dr. Green, please.
Thank you. It's the end of, I think it's been a really wonderful conference here. And I want to thank Concordia Seminary, David Scarra, and the whole seminary for the hospitality here. It's been a very high point, I think, coming here to this great meeting. It's been a great privilege being together with the men at the table here. I think we had a very fine group of speakers. It was really a moving experience to me. I've known Carter Lindbergh for years as a fellow member of the Association of Historians. We've been together at history meetings, and I've known him as a very scholarly, very scientific researcher. And today I learned to know you, Carter, as a Christian brother. And it was really great to learn to see you in this way. I'd like to, I'm glad I have this chance to say a couple of words. I guess I said a lot in the paper the other day and about a lot of things. And several things, a lot of you were very kind and you talked with me about the paper, and this gives me a chance to answer a question that maybe was left in the minds of some. I still like that formulation. Dr. Klon pointed out that Melanchthon's genius was in making distinctions. Sometimes we agree with those distinctions and sometimes we don't. I like the thought that Luther's genius was in the line of the paradox. The formula of Concord could not be made up of paradoxes. It really, in a sense, tried to resolve the paradoxical. The question somebody asked me, does that mean that we don't want to have the formula of Concord anymore? Not at all. I hope that there wasn't any question about my own personal commitment and subscription of the formula of Concord. I think the formula of Concord is a magnificent statement coming at the end of the Reformation, and I think it very successfully brings together a synthesizing of the teachings of Luther and Melanchthon and all the rest. And I would just publicly like to state my commitment to the formula of Concord. But we can't stay with the year 1577. I think I was also asked if I was a Melanchthonian instead of a Lutherian. The answer is no. As a historian, I sometimes get too much of a certain holy fire to clear some of the past mistakes. I think there have been a lot of historical errors in treating Melanchthon. Having said that, I really do not want to follow Melanchthon very much. I really want to follow Luther. And in the dogmatics that I want to write, if God gives me time and strength and a few other things, I want to write a dogmatics in which I do not like Lutheran orthodoxy, which I highly respect, do not follow Melanchthon, but get back to that other thing that we have in the formula of Concord, Luther and his paradoxes, and write a dogmatics that starts out from the principle we cannot know God except as God has chosen to make himself known to us. And instead of talking about doctrines of attributes and so forth, take these two attributes, that God remains hidden, the Deus Absconditus, until he unveils himself in Jesus Christ, the child of Bethlehem, the man of Calvary. And in this making known of himself to us, God has shown us whom we have to deal with, and that from there on, theology is the distinction of law and gospel.
Thank you very much, Dr. Green, especially on behalf of the Formula of Concord. Dr. Scarf.
I wish to thank those who came from off campus to participate on behalf of the faculty. Appreciate Lowell and Richard Klan and Carter Lindbergh. Appreciate Kurt Marquardt for being the chairman for this session and for the whole meeting. It's been a very wonderful job, Kurt. In regard to the question that is posed about what is exactly Lutheranism going to have to face as we come to the end of this particular century, I think if I had to pick out a date which was determinative for the situation which we are going to face, I think I would choose the date of 1974, in which the St. Louis faculty divided itself. And that particular historical moment created the situation which I believe that we are in now, and that is, before we were speaking of multiple Lutheran churches, now we are speaking really of only two major Lutheran bodies. On one side is the Missouri Synod, and the other side is the ELCA. And I think this has put us in a very strange situation that perhaps did not exist. I suppose we could say that maybe what some conservatives have wanted, at least this is what Christian News has suggested over the years, has finally happened, that we have two recognizably different Lutheran churches, and in a certain sense, the ecumenical age for Lutheran discussion has come to an end. And that is, before the ALC was in the position of being in a mediating position, that is, while it was in fellowship both with the Missouri Synod and the LCA back in the 60s and the 70s. But I really wonder if we are signaling the end of these ecumenical age a little bit too soon, for the following reason. It is a rather strange and unusual circumstance that for this week's symposium, two men were brought to our campus, Dr. Stummer, formerly from the ALC, and Carter Lindbergh from the LCA, in order to speak a word, not necessarily of encouragement, but also a word of a little bit of law in regard to the type of programs which the Missouri Synod is adopting. Just when we thought that the line between conservatives and liberals was so clearly made, that one would be in one church and the other would be in the other church, it is almost as if the Missouri Synod is going hat in hand to those who had formerly opposed. We are living in the ecumenical age, and regardless of how we stand on the attitude of closed communion, we are all involved in it and we are all participating in it. And I think there's a reason. It's not that we have to participate in it. We are, in fact, participating in it, in that we are actually dependent across lines, sometimes very clear-cut lines, cross-cut lines. And we might find ourselves today, in this point, very much in a position that our forefathers found in the early 19th century, when the church had suffered through the ravages of pietism, and then rationalism, and then Schleiermacher. And there was a revival at that time of confessional Lutheranism, of course, of which we are all the product here, of that of those men, of their faith and what they have done. The one thing which I won't say disturbs me, but I think we can note, and that is, I'm not so sure that those historical types of revivalism, of confessionalism, can necessarily be planned. It was almost as if our fathers did not plan it and they stepped into it. Now, there is an attempt, I believe, at this time to bring about a revivalism. The situation in the New Lutheran Church, I think, is somewhat critical in this sense, that when a church body defines its goals on its ecumenical contacts, whether that's going to be with Episcopalians or Reformed or Roman Catholics, and those various movements or for that type of association is present, when that becomes the prime motivation of any church group, now that church is going to be in a very difficult situation. And it could be that it is not impossible, but it could very well be that out of desperation in the New Lutheran Church, some people could go back to their roots to find out what exactly it means to be Lutheran. This happened in 1817 and it happened in 1830. There's no reason why it can't happen here. Now, the Missouri Synod, I think, is at the time, I don't know if it's going to be successful. We are, we have just gone through a Walther anniversary, and there is an attempt to revive some of Walther's specific and peculiar doctrines and attitude towards life. I think the danger there is that historicism can be substituted for theology. I think in his attempt, I think what Richard Klein said is true. We just simply cannot revive the past. I think it's a comfortable thing to do. I'm not so sure that an historical revival is going to answer the theological. I think if we would simply do that and do nothing else, we would be theologically irresponsible. And the other way in which, of course, the Missouri Synod is also adrift in this situation, I think it's been demonstrated here slightly at this meeting over the various discussions, and that's where we're going. And there's one movement that wants to go back to historicism, and there's the other who believes that the future of the church is going to be found in its programs, and thus we're having almost one experimental type of program or ministry following another in many of our congregations. Now comes the question, on whose shoulders does the responsibility for this fall? I would suggest that the responsibility for this falls primarily on the shoulders of the pastor. And if I had to pick out one weak point, it would be in the ministerium specifically, simply because this lack of vision, which the church seems to be a little confused about, I think is primarily found sometimes in the pastor himself, who is neither certain of his position as a pastor or what his responsibility is over confessional Lutheranism. As I said before, I do not think that historicism is going to answer this particular problem. And one of the problems which I see in the Missouri Synod is I believe that we are in grave danger of losing the pastoral office. I believe my colleague, Dean Wenthe, spoke to that issue, at least more or less, about 2 days ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sker. And now, having already received honorable mention, please, Professor Wenthe.
Thank you, Kurt. The point I would like to come back to is one that I've heard over these days and to me is exceedingly refreshing. That is, if the gospel, in all of its confessional glory, is that which we seek to hold up. And I don't think it was accidental that Luther brought that gospel clarity to the church at a time when it was reviving a sense of the first century church, where people again were turning to the scriptures and to the original languages to see how God had, in a miraculous way, blessed that early church. And if we look back I don't think we have to repristinate or have a sort of historicism to see that they face clash of culture, at least in the magnitude that we face it, for they lived in the midst of Hellenism and a virulent Judaism in many guises, and yet built around the apostles and prophets, they were critiquing both cultures, and they were building a teaching that reflected faithfully the apostolic voice. Now, I think we can, with Luther, return there for some very helpful instruction instead of going to Fuller Seminary. Indeed, Martin Chemnitz, when he delivers his great books, appeals to the apostles and prophets, but he also knows fully the church's history. And what I believe we'll discover there is very liberating, that in the objective means of grace, there is a marvelous motivation to be zealous and creative in our missionary works. And I guess I'm fortunate. I've heard a couple references to Missouri's lackadaisical attitude, but I grew up under a pastor who was very zealous to hold up the gospel, but he was also very confessional. And as that gospel is held up, I think there are times when it's going to pinch us, and we're going to be called to suffer like the early church. And if I could just give one example. A colleague was recently at a pastoral conference and sharing some casuistic discussion on the response of the church to marriage and divorce, which is a very real problem in our culture. And he expressed a number of viewpoints, and shortly thereafter was told, that's ridiculously legalistic. At which point he said, well, I'm sorry, but that's been the position of the church for two millennia. And what I think we must be very careful about is losing our continuity with the way the gospel has been preserved by the church through the ages. In the memorial service this morning, we confessed and sang about the unity that is ours with the saints that have gone before. And I think Lutherans, in their desire to preserve the gospel, have a great stake in that continuity, creatively applied, but objectively held to in the gospel and the means of grace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Norman Nagel, please.
As called and ordained servants of the word, we are there for delivering the gifts of salvation, and they are all wrapped up in the forgiveness of sins. The delivery is located in the means of grace, and we by our ordination. And we're worth nothing to anybody except as we are servants of that delivery of the forgiveness of sins. But just as there is a specific locatedness in the means of grace and in the holy ministry, so there are the specific people whom we are put there to be the servants of in delivering the forgiveness of sins. And each one of them is different, and we live in a very pluralistic society. And if we are going to communicate, get through the gifts, we're going to have to know an awful lot about each one of those people and of the society that shapes them. and the multi-shapedness of people in a pluralistic society. And therefore, we need an ever better trained and educated clergy. For how else will they know to be on target with the people whom they are put there to serve? The people are shaped by all of the zeitgeist factors. And it's only as we are able to lead them to the limit of what idols are there supplied to them that we may help them come to the point of facing those points at which their idols break down. We need to know their idols terribly well, as the explanation to the first commandment in the Large Catechism says. An idol isn't an idol because it's an idol. It's an idol because it isn't believed. It's unbelief which makes an idol. And so we are useful as we bring people to the recognition of, if they will only trust their idols, then they will be to the point where they cannot stand the strain of being treated as God. All of that is the way of the diagnosis and the message of the law, and to that despair point of, is there any hope? Or that question, coram Deo, does God care? Can there be forgiveness for such a one? And that message of forgiveness rings in its clarity and gifting strength the more recognizably it is not running in the way of the idols of the zeitgeist. People are got at in 100 and 1,000 different ways. All of the manipulations of advertising and societal pressure, they know when people are trying to work them to their end or purpose. To the extent that we are identified as doing the same thing with them, we will be written off as worthless, and justly so. The message of forgiveness is too good to be true. Could there be such a God who would care about me in a society where I am such a disposable item? Who cares? So if they can identify us as marketing manipulators, as hucksters and hustlers to get our quota, they will write us off. If we are there for nothing but the delivery of the forgiveness of sins, there is something they could never have dreamt of. And it will bring them to life as children of God. And as children of God, they will have left behind any trust in the idols that have failed. when it says in the psalm, put not your trust in princes, it's not abolishing princes. The kingdom of the left hand runs by princes and the way they exercise pressures and powers. In our society, one might call them the corporations. So many people's lives are run by corporations. And they know what size of life is a life that is run by a corporation. I would suggest that if you point to 1974, the danger is that now we took, we cleaned up that doctrinal mess then, and now we've got other things to be getting on with and worrying about. The district presidents, when they speak about the students from the seminary, they say, oh, the doctrine's okay, but they're not much use at interpersonal relations. Their job is make people feel good, welcome, embracing. Now, this is caricaturing, but there are evidences for us to see how the way in which the world is shaping, or seeking to shape itself, us to its own image. Our danger is the corporization of the church. When you get the church news bulletins, see how much of it fits under the hypothesis of a corporation. In what way is this recognizably different from something you could be hearing about a corporation?
Thank you, Dr. Nagel. And now please, Dr. Carter Lindbergh.
Well, I too would like to thank all of you for your hospitality and kindnesses, and especially those of you who planned this program. I appreciated being invited and have enjoyed being here. And I especially like your global questions. And so what do I suggest for the future of Lutheranism and the world and all that? Two people come to mind. One, Sidney Mead, the American historian of religion in America, and the other, the English Methodist Luther scholar Gordon Rupp. Sidney Mead said of Lutherans in America one time, they reminded him of a football huddle. You know, all we generally see of Lutherans is their backsides, but we keep thinking maybe they're discussing something interesting. And Gordon Rupp said, there's probably nothing quite so bad with the Lutherans that a good dose of Luther might not help. And so I guess I would want to leave you with these kinds of thoughts, that I think that our tradition has a great deal to offer, but we haven't been doing too much to offer it. And so I look to increased ecumenical discussions, I mean, serious ecumenical discussions. It's remarkable how much you begin to learn about your own tradition when you have to talk to people in other traditions. And that's it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lind. I must thank the panel. They were not at all difficult. Some panels, it's like pulling teeth, but these were quite forthcoming. So I now hurry on to the two questions that have been given in writing. Number one, what leadership will Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne take in providing an alternative to the church growth movement, Kennedy evangelism, etc.? Negative criticism is helpful in showing error, but positive action is needed now. And since we have the academic dean and the deputy academic dean right here, I'm going to direct this question first of all to Dr. Asker, who can always be counted upon to call a spade, and at least I thought so until today, when I saw him sporting a watch labeled International Harvest, sir, which everyone knows is nothing but a grandiose euphemism for the Grim Reaper. So, alternatives.
Well, so far as alternatives are concerned, I think I should take the route which my dear brother and colleague to the right, Carter Lindbergh, has taken on a number of questions. That is, he has confessed his inadequacy, and I think I am going to do the same too, because I think I'm in a position of hearing what they should say are what the alternative is here at the seminary, rather than we doing that ourselves. So I would like to defer, first of all, to our colleagues, Carter Lindbergh first, and then to the gentlemen from St. Louis and Lowell, who are of the Missouri Synod. I would prefer that than telling you what I think should be done. I'd hate to tell what should be done today. The Board of Regents is meeting in a few minutes.
Well, as Dr. Johnson said, it's amazing how the knowledge that one is to be executed in a fortnight's time clarifies the mind. As Deputy Academic Dean, Dr. Wenthy, would you wish to add anything?
Well, I think the seminary in Fort Wayne could do much to contribute positively by sending my colleague, Dr. Norman Nagel, on tour of the Senate and saying what he just said at the panel. It would be a marvelous.
Very good. We're getting very concrete now. Anything else? Any other member of the panel wishes to say to this? Otherwise, I'll take the next question, which is a little more formidable. For the panel, pick up from Thursday, comments about not reckoning with results. If, in parentheses, the word is preached and taught faithfully and pure, but visible results, gains versus losses, are not forthcoming, as with prophets who were killed or exiled, yes. But if churches are decimated by loss of members protesting false teaching, losses do not count against the teacher who departs from the right doctrine of Scripture. Romans 14, St. Paul condemns those who for meat destroy the work of God. No faithful pastor may or will take recourse to I preach it as I see it and let the chips fall where they may. I think I'll have to address it to Dr. Norman Nagel because that discussion arose, if I recall, out of gifts. Did you form an overall impression of the question, or should I?
I was just an instrumental transmitter of the gift.
Of this paper, yes. But I think the point that the questioner is quite genuinely getting at is, what about this matter of not reckoning with results? Can it not also serve as an excuse for indolence and smugness, something like that?
There are pastors who are lazy. There are pastors who are ignorant and who are proud of it. There are faithful pastors whose lives are spent with declining statistics. If we recognize some yardsticks of the law, replacing them with others is still running with yardsticks. And that it gives no final ground. It's a question, I suppose, of first and second level questions. The first one is always, whose church is it? And we fall out of acknowledging that it's the Lord's church the moment we ask, what do we have to do about it? We are nothing but at the receipt of gifts. And he does his work, the Holy Spirit, where and when it pleases him. To lay any coercion, must, or surefire program down is to be in contradiction of that fact. As Dr. Walther has taught us, however, we should not hesitate to preach, finally, nothing but the whole gospel for fear that it may be abused. We are always looking for cushions for the flesh and excuses, but that's, again, slumping into the way of the law. I think we will move forward together as we embrace together the primary confessions, the small catechism, and what the third article says. There's nobody here who's wanting to chuck that. But there are those who have been pulling it apart and twisting it. And that needs to be recognized, but not to show that they don't care whether people go to hell, and these people do, just because your church isn't growing, does that prove you're a good Lutheran? That level of comment, I think, we should by now have left far behind as we gather at what we confess together.